Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Luc Menand has written a monumental catalog of the free world that staggered, then strutted out of World War II in 1945. His subtitle is Art and Thought in the Cold War. You can read it now as a cultural history of the short American century, 25 or 30 years through the 60s, about us when we were young. Us at our best, perhaps. Voracious, experimental, outreaching, networking the codes of an adolescent empire, launching ideas that would shape a vast array of baby boomers. Minority liberations were dawning. Education and entitlement were expanding through the GI Bill and the SAT. For me, Luc Menand, it's a story of how my little post-war American brain and yours got inspired, maybe mesmerized, by the magic word freedom. That freedom label goes every which way in the culture of the 40s, 50s, 60s. But start out, Luc, with the big political frame. Freedom was defined by the alternative, the totalitarianism of George Orwell's 1984, and by Orwell himself in this reenactment of his deathbed warning in 1950.
This is the direction the world is going in at the present time. In our world, there will be no emotions except fear, rage, triumph, and self-abasement. The sex instinct will be eradicated. We shall abolish the orgasm. There will be no loyalty except loyalty to the party. But always, there will be the intoxication of power. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
That's a founding document of this era, Luc Menand. Orwell thought that the evil of Stalinism was enough to justify another war against the Soviet Union. Sounds crazy. You remind us that 90% of the German deaths in World War II were inflicted by those Soviets. 26 million dead Russians, 50 times what Britain lost or the United States. I mean, what was the great Orwell thinking here about the enemy?
Orwell believed that, or he thought it was possible, that totalitarianism was just the way mass societies were going to work. He was influenced by other thinkers who'd had this idea before him. But 1984 is just an incredibly powerful representation of what, in Orwell's vision, might happen if tendencies continued the way that they were going. That's very powerful because a lot of people who knew very little about the Soviet Union, very little about totalitarianism as a political system, thought they knew about those things because they read 1984. That's the most widely read text in that period about this subject. So this anxiety that totalitarianism is in the basically DNA of modern societies is everywhere. People worry about the world becoming fascistic, about the world becoming communistic.
Right.
And it colors the way people talk about everything, art, ideas, music, literature. And that's part of what characterizes this immediate post-war period.
Yeah. It's almost a panic attack under this freedom burst. But speak of George Kennan, the other great Cold War pillar in your book. Ironies all over the place. He was a career diplomat, kind of patrician from Minnesota, the father of the containment theory with respect to Russia. But what worried Kennan was Russia, the old sullen bear, tyrannized for centuries and wounded. It wasn't the communist cover story. In Kennan's mind, as you interpret it, the great danger for the United States was the temptation to combine power politics with a moral mission to turn containment from a pragmatic foreign policy into an anti-communist crusade backed by nuclear bombs, which is pretty much how it turned out.
Yeah, containment theory is, from an international relations point of view, a realist theory, meaning that we shouldn't worry about what goes on inside other countries. That's their business. The only thing we should care about are things that the Soviet Union does that might impinge on our national interest. And so the doctrine of containment says, keep communism in its box. Don't let it expand. And as long as we keep doing that, it will self-destruct of its own inefficiencies. And that's the theory, in spite of the great arms buildup and a lot of rhetoric about liberation and rollback and so forth. That's basically the theory that the United States followed through the first 20 years of the Cold War. And the crisis of it is Vietnam.
Luke, speak of Hannah Arendt. I put her among the key minds from the start of the argument about totalitarianism. As you say, did it encompass both Hitler's fascism and Stalin's communism? Did they have a common root? It was the founding idea battle in your period. Her answer was that both fascism and communism were founded on mass organizations, she said, of atomized, isolated individuals. It had something to do with the problem of modernity in general.
Yeah, her take was actually quite similar to Orwell's. And that's the idea that in mass societies, people become anomic. They lack something to feel part of a social collectivity. And what they latch onto is the party and the ideology of the party, Communist Party or the Nazi Party. And they become identified with that, and that becomes the source of their rootedness. So she, like Orwell, worried that this could happen in any mass society, that there's something, in other words, called totalitarianism, which is not about ideology. It's actually about the use of the tools of propaganda and political state to organize the masses into these powerful killing machines. In her mind, the characteristic feature of totalitarian states is the concentration camp. Because the people who are imprisoned in concentration camps and slaughtered in concentration camps and death camps have done nothing wrong. They're there just because of who they are, and they can't escape that.
In your big book, Luke, The Free World, there's another big cluster of ideas coming this way from Paris in the 40s and 50s under the umbrella existentialism, and it connects with all sorts of issues, war, peace, the U.S., the world.
The existentialist point is that we are confronted all the time with choices. And the point is that we need to make those choices freely without feeling coerced by other people or by circumstances or even by our own emotions. We have to make those choices for ourselves freely. And once we've made that choice, we have to take responsibility for it. We have to own it. That becomes our choice. That's the kernel of existentialism.
It's incredible to think of that gruff, tiny little man, Jean-Paul Sartre, parading around Hollywood in 1944 or 5, whatever it was. I mean, did he have traction? Did those ideas rub off in any measurable way?
Sartre's ideas, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course they did. Yeah, he was a very charismatic guy. He was very amiable person. He loved to talk. He loved to drink. He did a Daffy Duck impersonation that was supposed to have been quite good. You know, he's 5'2". He has a walleye. He's a very weird looking guy. But people found him adorable. That's part of his charisma.
Luke Menand, stand back a moment and look forward and back here. It took me a while reading your book to make the profound connection with your masterpiece of 20 years ago, The Metaphysical Club. That was about a movement of ideas coming out of our own civil war, summed up as pragmatism. The William James short form might have been, think twice, judge any idea by its results. Beware the turn of any idea into an ideology. This new book, The Free World, is a modern story of something vaguely parallel, incredible post-war conditions to begin with, economic and political, social, but grief, remorse, and it's becoming a cauldron of ideas and how they played out. But at the same time, I'm also looking for hints in our present day, 2021, coming out of a pandemic and the ideas that we honor as we rebuild. Sum up the fundamental conditions of this post-war that produced the free world, freedom as the mantra.
When we look back now, there is a sense, you're right, in which the conditions of circa 1945 are somewhat parallel. So 1945, we weren't just coming out of a world war that had lasted 6 years, almost 6 years. We're also coming out of a Great Depression that had lasted almost 10 years. People were ready for a fresh start. It was a period of economic prosperity in every country in the world, not just in the United States, and a period of relative equality of income and wealth compared to before and after. And the United States, which has a kind of isolationist history, decided to play an active role in that post-war world. And we did a lot of things that we regret, a lot of things that put us in bad repute, and which we're still suffering from. But we also created conditions for a lot of creative ferment. Today, we're not only coming out of the pandemic, which is, of course, sort of shut down life for a year or so, but we're also coming out of, I hope, a period of nationalist backlash, isolationist backlash, nativism. And we have the opportunity to regard that as a blip, and to look forward to a greater period of international cooperation, which is the role the United States played in the early Cold War. And I think there's reasons, benefits that come from doing that. And if we look back on the earlier period, we can see some of what those benefits might be.
You say at some point, it's something like tracking down the names of people your parents talked about at the dinner table, and they were just names, but who the hell were they?
I grew up in a fairly academic or intellectual household, and my parents were interested in politics mainly. They were sort of New Deal Democrats. And, you know, they had a lot of this stuff. I mean, my father had The Origins of Totalitarianism, and he had Liberal Imagination, Lionel Trilling's big book. And I remember they talked about John Cage and Jackson Pollock. I mean, they weren't that interested in avant-garde art. They were pretty conservative in terms of culture, but they didn't watch television, for example. But most of these were people whose names I'd heard about. I remember reading The Feminine Mystique or some tiny bit of it when it was came out in 1963. I was 11 years old, and yeah, we had it in the house. So then I thought, well, why were these people important such that my parents knew about them? Why did I know about them?
Absolutely. Worked that way for me. My parents were very different from yours, not academic. My father hadn't finished high school. My mother had graduate degrees from Chicago. But they were always talking big ideas, Christianity, socialism, food, living, and all of these names ring bells. Coming up, the year that models it all is 1947. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The post-war got traction in 1947. Harry Truman told Congress it's now us against the Russians. Christian Dior presented his new look in Paris, and Americans bought into it. Jackson Pollock made his first drip paintings in 1947. Jackie Robinson became the first black man in big league baseball, a very big deal. George Marshall, the Secretary of State, announced the rescue plan for Europe in a Harvard commencement speech, the Marshall Plan. In November 1947, Walter Lippmann called it a Cold War coming. And by the way, Charlie Parker chose Bud Powell to be his pianist in a quintet with Miles Davis, Tommy Potter, and Max Roach. Everything was happening. Luke Menand, can you discern a presiding mind in all that flourishing of youth culture and pop art, beat poets, and highbrows in painting and prose?
One person who's very important is Clement Greenberg, who's the art critic. And by the 1950s, he was sort of the voice of authority in the art world. And he was a great champion of the abstract expressionists, and in particular of Jackson Pollock. Then there's the New York intellectuals who are identified with Partisan Review, which emerges as a kind of leading left-wing anti-communist journal after 1945. Which everybody, all the important intellectuals seem to write for.
But an important little point here. You talk about Partisan Review being liberal and anti-communist. You dedicate this book, Luke, to your father. You describe him as a civil libertarian, an environmentalist, and an anti-anti-communist. Explain that. It's important.
Yeah. It's an important split in the liberal wing of the Democratic Party between anti-communists and anti-anti-communists. So my father wrote his dissertation on loyalty oaths and he was opposed to McCarthyism, loyalty oaths. He thought that America should not intervene militarily in other countries, and we were too quick to do that. So that split really begins in the late 1940s, and then, of course, it blows up in Vietnam.
It's a very important split. Hubert Humphrey, perfect example of the anti-communist. I.F. Stone, great hero of mine, anti-anti-communist. Don't intervene. Stay home. Noam Chomsky. Back to the painters. Jackson Pollock is one of a type in your book. Creative artists of the post-war period didn't invent these new forms and looks and sounds so much as they fell backward into them and then had to figure out what was working. You could say that about Elvis, too. Explain that point about Jackson Pollock.
That's what's also interesting about these stories is there's just so much that's accidental and serendipitous that was never planned for. So in the case of the drip paintings, when Pollock married Lee Krasner, they moved out to this place called Springs, which is in the Hamptons, and at a time when it was cheap to live there. And in this new house, the walls were not large enough for Pollock to stretch a canvas. This is the story.
This is a legend, right?
And so he puts it on the floor, and he starts throwing paint on it. He usually uses either a brush or a stick. Then they renovate this barn on the property, and Pollock moves his studio in there. And Greenberg comes out to visit them, and he encourages Pollock to continue painting with the canvas on the floor, which Pollock does. So for 3.5 years, from probably the spring or summer of 1947 till late fall of 1950, Pollock makes these unbelievable paintings. In other words, it worked, but they didn't know why it worked. And they had to figure it out afterwards, like, why is this working? You know, in a traditional painting, you put the painting on an easel, canvas on an easel, and the canvas functions essentially as a window onto the landscape or the person you're trying to represent and your painting. If you take it off the easel and put it on the floor, it's a completely different idea of what constitutes a painting. And that was basically the gesture that Pollock made.
Come back to who you think of as thought leaders. Where's Noam Chomsky in your landscape of ideas? He would have been big in my history.
So he really emerges as an influential intellectual during the Vietnam period. And I sort of stop when we get to 1965. So I don't get into that.
I would have said Muhammad Ali was a thought leader in this country, even in this period. I would say even at the end of the story, Muhammad Ali stands out as a man who saw the peril, saw the human truth of our situation, and at enormous cost to himself, daring, made the world listen.
I'm saying you're talking about me, about some draft, and all of you white boys are breaking your neck to get to Switzerland and Canada and London. I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now, right here fighting you. If I'm going to die, you my enemy. My enemy is the white people, not Viet Cong or Chinese or Japanese.
Again, I mean, so I didn't want to get into the Vietnam. I didn't want to cover the Vietnam period. I wanted to stop just short of that.
Other people in this story, Mario Savio of the free speech movement. I mean, where does he rank? Not a monster intellectual exactly, but called a tune.
Savio was a big figure in that movement, and he gave this speech before the students occupied the administration building, Sproul Hall, in 1964, which is one of the famous speeches of the old New Left. And what I think is important about the speech is it's not about free speech at all. His speech is about the university as a system of socializing people to become part of industry and the state. It's treating human beings as basically mechanical parts or instruments. And he has this great metaphor. We have to throw ourselves on the gears of the machine to make it stop.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
And that's actually an image out of Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times.
Yeah, Noam Chomsky continues it in a way, an important book on the new mandarins, but about not just Vietnam, but how the universities had become propagandist in a way, or a network of inculcating what? Helplessness or followership in their students, which reminds me of sort of a big three paradox in your book. You conclude in a certain way that our politics sustains democracy, our social habits promote conformism, but it's our culture in the end that saved us in this period, that went worldwide, that was confident, that was attractive, somehow sounder than anything else. Do I have it right?
Yeah. I'll put it this way. I think that a lot of people thought what you just said, that is to say, a lot of people thought politically the United States was a good place because ordinary citizens cared about politics. For Hannah Arendt, that was the key to everything. If you don't care about politics, you'll suffer. So She thought America was a great place because people cared about politics, whether they were personally affected by it or not. So, but that was a kind of popular view of European emigres, that America was a conformist, socially conformist place, but politically was enlightened. Putting aside whether it really was a conformist place or not, I think it's a cliche of the period, but that it's out there. I think the second part of your point is right, which is that in the end, it was the ability of the United States to transform these world trends in art and thought into something and become the center of the distribution of those works that saved us, essentially. It made us into a civilization.
And a world power.
And a world power, that's right.
My short form for my kids growing up was, why do they call it the American century, or what made the American century? I said it was Franklin Roosevelt's late entry into World War II and the way we came out of it virtually intact industrially and geographically. And secondly, the Basie Band, which mastered 4/4 time to such depth that, and it underlies rock and roll, hip hop, it underlies everything, and it took over the world. Change categories a little bit. One illustration of your point comes in the form of a book that was ever present in our house growing up. It's called The Family of Man. It was a picture book, all sorts of people all over the world. I was never sure I got the point, but it seemed to have a moral message in it, a way of thinking about people. You connected significantly to the anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss and something called structuralism, which I had never heard of. Explain The Family of Man, what that book meant.
Yeah, so The Family of Man, the book that you had was the catalog for a photography exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art. I think it was 1955. It consists of some hundreds of photographs, some taken by well-known photographers and some by amateurs from all over the world, showing human beings in forms that are universal. So families, children, grieving, marriage, work, play, and so on.
Connected to anthropology in general, which could be seen through that lens as a kind of repair work in the post-colonial period, finally getting to know the people that Europe had dominated. But it also had to do with what's called structuralism.
So the main figure here is Claude Lévi-Strauss, the French anthropologist. And Lévi-Strauss was Jewish, and he had to flee Europe after 1940 when the Germans invaded France, and he was able to get to the United States. The main idea of structuralism, if I could put it in 2 minutes for you.
On a bumper sticker, please.
Yeah. The main idea is that, so on the surface, languages are all different, but underneath they're all basically based on the same phonetic systems, and each language group uses its phonetic system in its own way to produce its own vocabulary, its own languages. Mm. So translating this to study of culture, which is what anthropologists were doing, what Lévi-Strauss was doing, all cultures look different on the surface, but underneath they're all basically performing the same functions. There's a kind of structure that underlies them that explains how these varieties appear. So that's very similar to The Family of Man in the sense that The Family of Man shows that people around the world all look different from each other. There's physical differences. People dress differently. Different cultures have different artifacts that are associated with them. But deep down, human life is the same everywhere.
Okay. Okay, from the family of man and its politics, so to speak, to pop art, another big event in this period, embodied in Andy Warhol. I got to say, I never got Andy Warhol, which was maybe the point. But why do serious people still take him as a serious innovator?
Andy Warhol was a great artist, Chris. He just was a great visual artist. He had great compositional sense, had great color sense. Any kind of art he wanted to do, he probably would have been successful at it. But, of course, he's identified with pop art. And
soup cans, but also movies.
He also made movies, yeah. So one thing to understand about Warhol, art is all he did. He was very serious about art. He collected art. He went to other people's shows. He also went to theater. He went to dance. He was, you know, he was very plugged in New York and the cultural world. He knew all those people. He was appreciated for their work. So he understood where he stood in the history of art because he knew the history of art. He was trained.
Right. And he had bought very successfully, very shrewdly in a sense. But where did he see himself in the history of art?
By the time he was discovered as a pop artist in 1962, pop art was already on the scene. Lichtenstein had already done his comic strip paintings, and James Rosenkranz was already painting, Jim Dine. A lot of these early pop artists had already come on the scene, already doing what we would call pop art. So Warhol was actually the last of the major pop artists to be discovered. And he had his first show in Los Angeles. He couldn't get a New York gallery. That was the Soup Cans. So that's in the summer of 1962. It's called 32 Campbell's Soup Cans. And this, everybody knows, it's 32 separate canvases showing different flavors of Campbell's soup. He actually got all the soup can labels and he traced them on, I think he used an opaque projector and then a stencil for the lettering and so forth. So if you look at them, actually, you can see they're hand painted. I mean, or the painting is applied by hand. And that was his breakthrough. That was his first show. And then he had some breakthrough shows in New York in 63 and 64. And by 64, he's become the face of pop art. So he's a very important figure because what his work ended up doing, in spite of his talent as a visual artist, essentially conceptual. So when you look at the soup can paintings, there's nothing to look at. Imagine 32 paintings of Sam Campbell's soup cans. It would have the same effect on you as actually seeing them. It's funny when you go to a museum and you see the soup cans are at MoMA, people stand there and stare at them, but there's nothing to look at. They're just painting soup can. Same with the Brillo box, a lot of that stuff. He's copying existing forms. He's not doing anything to them. So it's the idea of the soup cans. That's the artwork. And the same thing with the Brillo box and that stuff. So I think Warhol was very conceptual. And when he undertook to create something, he was thinking, conceptually, what's the next move here?
Conceptually meaning, what was the concept, so to speak?
So in the case of the soup cans, I think the concept seems very banal to us now. But I think in 1962, it was not banal. Which is that you can go to a supermarket and buy a Campbell's soup, or you can go to an art gallery and buy a painting of a Campbell's soup, and it's no difference. Hmm. It's just a consumer product. Later on, after 1968, Warhol actually inhabits this whole idea of business art. But even 1962, art's a businessman. He or she manufactures a product, puts it for sale in a store that specializes in that product, in this case an art gallery, and you can go buy it. And then if you're lucky, it'll appreciate in value. You can sell it to a museum. So that's part of the idea of that, of the soup can. The Brillo box is a more complicated idea. I think there were 300 boxes that were painted to look like cartons in a kind of supermarket warehouse. So it would be a big carton in which Brillo boxes would be packed. There was one for, I think, tomato juice and one for Del Monte's peaches or whatever. I think there were four or five different brands. The thing about the Brillo box is that people said, well, Duchamp has already done this, because Duchamp had found objects. The urinal is the most famous example. It's called Fountain. And he put them in an art gallery without changing them at all. And he called them ready-mades. And, of course, the idea is that in a hardware store, a snow shovel is just a snow shovel. But if I take a snow shovel and put it in an art gallery or a museum, it becomes a work of art. But it's identical to the snow shovel that I bought in the hardware store. The Brillo boxes look like that, but they're not actually found objects. They're painted. They're faux ready-mades. What Warhol was doing was playing a game with Duchamp's idea of the found object as an artwork by making an artwork that looked like a found object.
You know, a lot of people...
I can see you're not impressed by that, Chris.
No. No, I'm intrigued. We, like a lot of people, go to YouTube and look up some of these characters. Andy Warhol comes through in anything you can find in Google as utterly Delphic, mysterious, evasive, sort of off-putting in a nice way when you ask him, what's up? What are we doing here?
I mean, do you ever bother to read all these great interpretations about your work?
Can I just answer a little?
Yes, you can. When you and Rosenquist and Lichtenstein all were working very independently of each other, but evolving the same kind of attitude, does that seem odd to you that you all began to look at the world in the same way?
I think we just read a lot of comic books. And it just happened to come out then.
He lied. He lied all the time. So every time he was interviewed, he lied in the interviews. He lied about where he was from. He lied about how old he was. He lied about what his intentions were. He lied. Why did he do that? Because he liked to eliminate the one aspect of something that we think is essential to it and see what happened. So the one aspect to interviewing somebody is that essential to it is that they tell you the truth when you ask them a question. So he never told the truth. So all the sayings that are attributed to Andy Warhol are made up. He didn't mean them.
Including everybody has 15 minutes of fame?
Yeah, he probably didn't even say that, but he certainly didn't mean it. It's a wholly meaningless statement. But people picked up on these things because they were Delphic and gnomic. People thought, oh, that's really profound. That really explains something. They don't. It's incredible. So there's this whole history of things that Warhol said that he either didn't say or certainly didn't mean.
I still don't get it, which is just fine.
Okay.
Coming up. The Beats, and yes, the Beatles. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.
It's been a hard day's night.
Revisiting the short American century with Luke Menand, perhaps only in the free ferment of the post-war, could the Beatles have come so fast, so far, to outshine the sun. Luke Menand, they're not quite what we thought of the Beatles. They're not simple mopheads from Liverpool. They're accomplished artists in a certain way, even before they start. John Lennon, in a particular way. Retell that story as you understand it.
Yeah, the Beatles were tough characters.
And said so.
Yeah, they said, we're f***ing big bastards, is the way they put it.
Right, and they said, Ed Sullivan, yeah, we'd love to come on your show, but not once, three times in the contract, please. And they reached 75 million Americans.
Yeah. So they come to the United States, everybody knows, in 1964, after becoming kind of a fad in Europe. That's where Beatlemania originates. And the American press is very skeptical of them because they have these goofy haircuts. Basically, they were playing teeny bopper music, and they had these hysterical fans, 99% of whom were female. They arrive at Kennedy Airport and are hustled into the lounge at Pan Am to do a press conference. And they start asking them sort of hostile questions. And the Beatles are just incredibly funny and knocking the questions right back at the press. And the press starts to laugh. Reporters never laugh, Chris. They're laughing. You can see the pictures of it. It's hilarious. And the press is like completely smitten with these guys. Elvis Presley in a press conference would bumble. I mean, American pop music artists were not articulate, but the Beatles were really good at that, all of them. When they were coming over to America on the airplane, the story is that George said to Paul, or Paul said to George, or somebody said, what does America want us for? And the reason for that is because their fame in Europe was based on covering American rock and roll.
Right.
So they couldn't understand how that could be popular in a country whose music they were performing, since the country had its own musicians.
And Americans thought they were listening to something from England.
Yeah, they thought they were European. They read as European. They had these Scouse accents, which seemed very exotic, Liverpool accents. You know, they had a kind of metrosexual style, and then they had the haircuts. The breakthrough moment probably for the early Beatles that got adults interested in them was the movie A Hard Day's Night, which came out, I think, in the summer of 1964. And that kind of broke the Beatles through to an adult market, which people like Elvis Presley, Buddy Holly, and those kinds of musicians had limited access to. So that made them this kind of larger social and cultural phenomenon. And then, of course, it turned out that they were incredible songwriters. I mean, they have one of the great catalogs ever, and they just kept producing these fantastic songs. And as their audience got a little bit older, the songs got a little more sophisticated.
Right.
Asked a girl what she wanted to be. She said, baby, can't you see?
You make a wonderful point, Luke, that they did a turn on the use of black-rooted music. When white American musicians adopted that music, as many of them did, it looked like cultural appropriation. When white British musicians did it, it looked like homage.
Most of them that came over here, like Cream, the Animals, covered this R&B or blues music, Crossroads, you know, his famous Robert Johnson song and so on. People didn't think of that as appropriation somehow. So Eric Clapton could do stuff that Elvis couldn't do in a funny way. Mm. The British bands took race out of the equation for Americans. They just didn't read it that way.
Luke, you write sharply about Rolling Stone, the magazine, founded in 1967 by Jan Wenner, to cover the rock and roll world of the Beatles, Dylan, Mick Jagger and company. You say it's clear by now they weren't covering that world as much as they were inventing it. Meaning what?
They created the rock canon, which persists to this day. Rolling Stone saw the Beatles as growing out of Elvis Presley, and they saw Elvis Presley as growing out of Robert Johnson and the black music world. And that was a very important move to provide continuity between essentially British bands like Cream and Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and American music like Elvis and Arthur Crudup and so forth. And they made rock and roll a cultural winner. Mm. That was a big thing that Jan Wenner did. One thing that he edited out of that is that the people who made the Beatles and Elvis famous and popular were women, and the music that they were drawing from, in both the case of R&B and the case of Motown and the girl groups of the early 60s, was performed by blacks. But Rolling Stone was basically run by white men, and most of the early rock critics were famously white men. They didn't have a black writer at Rolling Stone until 1990.
That was amazing to hear.
Yeah, essentially the young white men took over this story.
With what net effect, do you think, other than keeping black voices out of the basic narrative of what was going on?
Well, I think that's the main effect. It's another case in which a black musical style becomes popular and it gets covered and basically co-opted. It's a familiar story, and it's true of jazz as well, of course. But I think on balance, the effect was good in the sense that it made rock a kind of Catholic genre.
Even if it was an illusion, you mean?
The canons are all illusions, yeah.
We haven't spoken enough about what was happening on campuses. Your special campus is Columbia, where Lionel Trilling was a sort of god of literary liberalism. One of his students was the proto-beat poet, Allen Ginsberg. They came to a breaking point that sounds like a big deal in this saga of freedom.
Allen Ginsberg got into Columbia, and he started taking courses with Trilling. He was a very popular teacher at Columbia College. And like a lot of people, Ginsberg became infatuated with Trilling. So Ginsberg would show Trilling his poems. This is very pre-beat, of course, and Trilling would respond or have him over for tea or whatever. And then at some point, Ginsberg wanted the relationship to be more a peer relationship or more personal. So he would tell Trilling personal things about himself, and he would want Trilling to tell Ginsberg personal things about himself. And Trilling basically drew the line. He said, I'm not interested in having that kind of relationship with you. Then Ginsberg gets into all kinds of trouble. He's arrested. He spends time in a psychiatric facility. Trilling helped keep him out of jail in that case. And he decides to go straight, no longer be gay, in other words. So he moves to San Francisco, gets involved with a woman, gets a real job, and then just decides that he doesn't want to live that way anymore, and he starts writing Howl. Hmm.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz.
Then in 1955, he gives a reading, and in the audience for that reading was Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who had got Ginsberg to publish the poem For City Lights. So Ginsberg, or later Trilling, said, "Dear Professor Trilling, here are some poems that I've been writing. I think this is a real breakthrough for me, and I hope that you admire them and you'll help promote them." So Trilling writes back this letter saying, Dear Alan, I'm sorry to say that I don't like the poems at all. They seem to be stale and unoriginal. And as for the ideology or the doctrine, of course, I reject it completely. So you're sincerely Lionel Trilling.
Wow.
That's 1955 or 1956. And then, of course, the poem comes out. And within 2 years, it's a huge, huge hit.
I must say, the beat figure that emerges out of your book and just thinking about him again is, for me, Jack Kerouac.
Yeah.
Explaining to Steve Allen when he asked, what does beat mean?
Yeah. I got the most tired question of all, but everybody always puts it to you, I'm sure. I mean, because everybody always puts it to you. How would you define the word beat? I don't mean why not time. I mean, really, is there...
Sympathetic.
Sympathetic? All right, I ask. And right now, we're looking to... Jack Kerouac's On the Road, and he'll lay a little on you. You know, you don't even have to buy these pages.
I was traveling west one time at the junction of the state line of Colorado, its arid western one, and the state line of poor Utah. I saw in the clouds, huge and massed above the fiery golden desert of Evenfall, the great image of God with forefinger pointed straight at me through halos and rolls and gold folds that were like the existence of a gleaming spear in his right hand, which saith, come on, boy, go thou across the ground. Go moan for man. Go moan. Go groan. Go groan alone. Go roll your bones alone. Go thou and be little beneath my sight. Go thou and be minute as seed in a pod. Go thou, die hence. And of this world report you well and truly. Anyway, I wrote the book because we're all going to die.
Yeah. Kerouac was a sympathetic guy. He's very vulnerable. He was somewhat shy, some insecurities. He wanted to be a great writer, as did Ginsberg. These are people who read Proust. You know, they read Rimbaud. They read Dostoevsky. I mean, they were serious, yes. Serious literary aspirations. But he was taken as a hipster, as a guy looking for kicks, you know, for girls and drugs and so on. That wasn't what he was like at all. And he hated that persona. And he became this famous best-selling writer based on an image that he felt was not himself.
I would have said that if there's a voice from the air that rings loud and clear, almost better than ever, it's James Baldwin's. But he's one of the people that you take down a peg or two. Explain now that.
I don't think I take him down.
Well, you make him something of a careerist.
Well, no more than the rest of us. I mean, he's a complicated person. And part of the complication is the fact that he wasn't always completely straightforward about his own biography. So he told stories about himself that don't really check out. And then he did build his career, a rather dramatic move of writing criticism of Richard Wright, who was his mentor, the most famous black writer in the world in the 1940s. And those pieces helped make Baldwin's name. And then he becomes a spokesman for the civil rights movement. There's a backlash against him in the early 1960s by white liberals who don't like the message that he's sending. The message that he's sending is a message that we're familiar with today, which is that white liberals need to acknowledge their complicity in the history of racial oppression in the United States. Mm-hmm. And white liberals don't like to think of themselves that way. They think they're enlightened. And they turned on Baldwin, and that's the story that I tell. I totally sympathize with Baldwin's position. I think he was an impossible place.
Speak of Hollywood, which is a central part of your story, partly because it's international, partly because it begins in France, early 20th century, and then flowers between Truffaut and Hitchcock. It comes to a sort of cultural struggle personified between two giant critics, Pauline Kael, who would end up at The New Yorker, and Andrew Saris of The Village Voice, around the theory of the auteur at the heart of any movie. It was Andrew Saris's line that any movie should be viewed not as a collaboration, but as an artistic statement of an individual director. Pauline Kael took the collaborative view. It was all kinds of crafts coming together. Sort that out if you can.
So auteur theory is the theory behind the French New Wave filmmakers like Godard and Truffaut. The idea is that the director is the author of a movie in the same way as the author of a novel, and that directors have certain styles or approaches or looks that they achieve in movie after movie. Think about the series of movies of Hitchcock, for example. Kale attacks Andrew Sarris and auteur theory in this famous article called Circles and Squares. Hmm. And that helped make her reputation as a critic of French theory. Now, I think the main reason behind her attack on Sarris was that she felt American film lovers were infatuated with European movies, and they were ignoring great American movies that were being made here.
Explain how that, all that played out around Warren Beatty's Bonnie and Clyde.
So Bonnie and Clyde was written by two men named Robert Benton and David Newman. And they wrote the screenplay, and then they showed it to François Truffaut. They wanted Truffaut to direct it, turned it down. And then they showed it to Godard. He got into a fight with the producers, and nothing came of it. So Warren Beatty came in and picked up the option, and he hired Arthur Penn to direct it. And Arthur Penn had actually been at Black Mountain School early on, and he knew what Benton and Newman wanted. And so in many ways, Bonnie and Clyde is a kind of American New Wave movie. It's supposed to be like a crime couple movie, very much like Godard's Breathless, but it's also very American. So it's a good example of something we've talked about before, which is American products influence Europeans who then come back with their own products influenced by the American product that then influences more American products.
Look, Ned, we're talking about your book, The Free World, the first three decades of the American century, our best, sort of wariest, but also most authentic time, it seems to me, the time of our growing up. I mean, one reads on with this sense of doom that this is going to end in Vietnam, and here we are 50 years after that. I mean, the question is sort of inescapable as this book goes on. Did this short American century blow it? What do you think?
You know, kind of, but Vietnam blew everything up. It all came crashing down in a way. Everything got politicized, everything got made militant.
And military.
Yeah, and the United States became the very imperialist power that it did not want to be in 1945. We burned through the political capital that we had accumulated by leading the fight against fascism, by helping to rebuild Western Europe and Japan, but we gained cultural capital. And in many ways, the cultural world that we live in now, which is very international, comes into being at the end of the 1960s.
You're also reminding me that Martin Luther King, in his August 63 speech, used the word freedom 20 times. He used the word equality once. There was a mark on the era, no question about it. And it was wonderful to live through it. You want to say that.
Okay.
I hope you feel that way.
You can say that.
Yeah. At the same time, an abysmal record in Vietnam. Also North Korea.
Oh, we did terrible things in Indonesia, terrible things in Iran. We did terrible things.
2 million dead in Vietnam. I mean,
yeah, it's all dark side to the story. We did terrible things. We continue to do that. So the hegemonic monster that we know the U.S. can be today, its origins are in this period as well. So we shouldn't forget that.
There's a perfect instance of your freedom theme, Luc Menand, in my head, but it's not in your book. It's jazz in general, and very concretely, it's Blue Note Records, formed by a German émigré in New York, the transatlantic touch, Alfred Lion, and it became a real home with a kind of family feeling for the giant artists of the new post-war sound and sensibility, the very different music of Thelonious Monk, but then Sonny Rollins, Bud Powell, Miles Davis, the whole University of Art Blakey, and many, many more. I'm also looking before the end, Luke, for the masterpiece of the era, or the presiding mind. Is there a modern Moby Dick that will be read forever, or a song that will be sung forever out of this free world period?
Tutti Frutti, I think, is immortal.
Interesting. I would say Kind of Blue, Miles Davis, Coltrane, Cannonball, Bill Evans.
I think we all have our favorites.
Well, but that went everywhere and stays everywhere.
So did Tutti Frutti, man.
Luc Menand, it's a pleasure to read your book, to be reminded of everything we grew up with, and it's great fun to hear you talk about it. Thank you.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Chris.
Louis, known as Luc Menand, is professor of English at Harvard and a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. His new book is The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from Chris Johnson and Michael Garth. Mary McGrath is our philosopher of freedom. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.